Welcome to Women with Issues, where we talk about policy issues that matter to women. We are focusing this series on the top priorities of women over 50 with regard to the 2020 elections coming up in November. Our bipartisan mission, because we've chosen to accept it, is simply to inform and educate you, women over 50, like ourselves, about the issues you care about in order to help you make a confident, informed decisions, at the ballots. Also, so you can show off to your family and friends your impressive knowledge of today's issues, you're welcome. I'm Diane Kilivris, along with the illustrious Tracy Maxwell Hurd, arguably the better half of Women with Issues.
Not even.
I want to thank everyone who's been listening. Our listenership has been growing every day, and that really is exciting for us. We want to ask you to keep listening, tell your friends, like and share us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at Women with Issues Podcast. We're also on Instagram and Twitter. We appreciate your feedback as well. We want to know what worked for you and what we can improve. Our last episode on race was our biggest episode yet with the greatest listenership. I think we struck a nerve, Tracy.
I think so.
So today we're going to continue that conversation, taking it into politics. So this is part two of our race episode, and we're going to address how each of the two presidential candidates, President Trump and the presumptive candidate, Senator Biden, are currently seeking to address race relations, particularly police brutality, which has recently become a very, very big issue and will likely be a huge issue with regard to the election. Tracy?
Definitely. We talked a lot last time about the emotional components of it and experiences that we'd had and the foundation of, you know, racism and how it's been institutionalized in the country. So we're going to take the other side of that today and really kind of talk about the what next and how we move forward and how we use this moment and the momentum of this moment to actually affect change. You know, these demonstrations, you know, we're at coming up under a month now of time that we have actually had people in the streets in all 50 states, in 18 countries around the world, and it's still continuing and it's expanding. And the thing that's really interesting is where it's expanding. You know, it's expanding into small, predominantly white townships. It's expanding into the suburbs. So people who really have not been negatively affected by racism are coming out and standing and saying, yeah, it's not acceptable and we need to do something about it. And that's a good thing, because one of the things that came out of all the stuff that I track every week, I think one of the most interesting comments that I heard was, and I'm not quoting verbatim here, but basically the comment was, Black people have to stop apologizing for racism still existing, because we're not the cause of racism. And until such time as we get, you know, the engagement of enough white people who understand the benefits that they receive as, you know, the result of that, and, you know, a lot of the things that Robin DiAngelo talked about in her book, White Fragility, then we're really not going to be able to affect any change, because it's much deeper than just the institutions and the systems. You know, it really is about changing hearts and minds, because institutions and systems are comprised of people. Right. And so until we really get into, you know, that level of engagement and change, you know, we're kind of going to kind of be stuck. But today we're going to talk about legislation, you know, some of the things that we know that are happening around, some of the things that are gaining traction, the whole conversation of defunding the police. What does that mean? Where, you know, is that going to happen? What could that possibly look like? And one of the things that we got, Diane was talking about, you know, please give us feedback. There was quite a bit of back and forth commentary from listeners on the racism conversation. And one of the things that came up was reparations. And that was a question to candidates back during the time when we had about 22 on the Democratic side. And I think about 8 weighed in. However, did some digging on reparations, just, you know, historically what it's meant, what, and we can talk a little bit about how does that play into this conversation and what does that mean? And as Diane said, of course, we're going to wrap up with Trump v. Biden in terms of where they stand and what they have both proposed in terms of how we should in this moment be responding to racism in this country.
Can I just interject because I think it's a good spot regarding your comments about getting into the hearts and minds of people, especially, you know, white folks who maybe didn't consider themselves racist, but now realize that they should be against racism. There was a Monmouth University poll released on June 2nd, and it showed that in 2016, 34% of Americans expressed that they believed that Blacks were more likely subject to excessive force by police. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, that number has risen in 2020 to 57% of Americans believing that Blacks are more likely to be subject to excessive force. And among white police in 2016, the number is 25% and jumped to 49% in 2020. So there it is in black and white, you know.
Exactly. So I think that's a significant increase. And certainly, you know, what's happening right now on the ground is definitely impacting that. But let's talk about a little bit of legislation. Something that has really been resonating and has been informing, I do believe, both Trump and Biden's agendas and what states and cities are doing all around the country is the hashtag 8 can't wait. So if you aren't familiar with that, I did reference that in part one of our podcast, but to run down what those are exactly, immediate harm reduction, which is use of force by police, demilitarization, the Department of Justice consent decrees, and police union contract. Comprehensive community safety, which is divesting from police, investing in community, including housing, jobs, and education. Some of the underlying factors that, you know, lead to criminal activity and engagement. Mm-hmm. Paying living wages, dramatically reducing jail and prison populations, and restorative justice. So, you know, what, getting rid of collateral sanctions. That was kind of part two of the legislation that I did when I was in the House. You know, when people come out of incarceration, you know, we say that we want people to reengage with society and be productive taxpaying citizens, et cetera, but then they can't get their license back. They can't get a job. They can't find a place to live. So we wonder why they fall back to, you know, what got them in trouble in the first place.
Right, right. They basically, you know, come out of incarceration with the clothes on their back, and a lot of their relationships have dissolved.
Exactly.
You know, and what, you know, what do they have to put on a resume?
Exactly. Yeah. Number three was abolition, fund community safety, fully defund police. That's one of them. And resource healthy community practices and needs. So, you know, like the Department of Jobs and Family Services, those kinds of things. So a lot of this is really about reappropriating funds.
Right.
Some other legislation that has come out is the Amy Cooper bill, which actually I believe was passed already in New York, and that is making it a felony. And I need to confirm that, so don't quote me on that. But it actually has passed. I'm not sure of the punitive side of that. So that there is a punishment if you dial 911, and it makes it a hate crime. That's what it does, for you to call 911 and incite any kind of racial response, as Amy Cooper did in the park, in the Ramble, against the gentleman who was just birdwatching and asked her to put her dog on the leash. So, and there have been lots of false cries prior to that also, you know, the police being called because, oh, people are barbecuing. Oh, people are standing outside washing cars. Oh, people, you know, and all of these things have been the result of people just doing normal things on their own property or in public spaces where, you know, those activities are allowed. So that has been labeled as a hate crime. Another thing is eliminating no-knock warrants. That has passed in a few states, eliminating fines and fees in court structures, because a lot of what happens, and this is the economic disparity that comes into play, is young Black men will get arrested, and because they can't post bond, end up sitting in jail And oh my gosh, I hate that I can't remember the young man's name, who was in jail for 2 years and ultimately committed suicide. He was arrested for stealing a backpack, which he didn't do.
I did.
And see that never story. Got due process, was incarcerated for 2 years. And I think it was, I forget how many days he was in solitary confinement, and ultimately committed suicide.
He was very young, wasn't he? 17 or so. We'll have to.
Young man. And I'm sorry, I hate to bring up things when I can't cite all the actual facts, but very well-known incident. So I'm sure our listeners know what we're referencing here. I mean, if you don't, look it up, because that's a real thing. It's not the only time that that has happened. Looking at our bail structure in our country and fees, and also, and this was part of the eight can't wait also, but a really big subject, which is equipment purchases, because there have been a lot of police departments. There's 18,000 police departments in this country, and they've had the opportunity to purchase surplus military supplies, you know, like tanks and, you know, automatic weapons and all kinds of things that you don't really need in regular policing in cities. You know, if we need that kind of power, then I think we do bring in the military. But that's a big part of the challenge that we're having right now, is having military presence at these protests.
President Trump, you know, when he talked about bringing in the military, and that's in addition to the National Guard, which was called in, he was pretty widely criticized, even by his own party, exactly. Members of his own party. Yeah, it's never been done that active military have been called in on its own people.
But what I really want to talk about is the defunding of the police. And that's part of the recommendation of the Eight Can't Wait. And what does that mean? Because defunding can be actually defunding and abolishing, or taking all of the money away from them, eliminating the police department altogether, or reforming the police department. What are we talking about? And a great example of that was in Camden, New Jersey. They actually fired everybody and started all over again.
Wow.
Yeah. And have had huge success in terms of violent crimes going down, reducing the stats on the disparity of black and white arrests and engagement with the police. Done a really great idea, and I've only seen that referenced one time. And I think, you know, when we're talking about looking at something that drastic, let's look at somebody who's done it and actually succeeded. They didn't eliminate their police department, but they did start all over from scratch and look at what components they built into that, like the community policing. But that's a part of what we need to talk about, because when we say defunding the police, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how practical it is.
Well,
how safe it is for us,
I know,
to eliminate entirely.
And you said, you know, people have visions of, you know, calling the police in an emergency and nobody comes, because
exactly.
Defunding the police, a lot of it means taking some money away from law enforcement and putting it towards crime prevention.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. After school programs in the communities. And then again, what we're going to talk about too, that's part of President Trump's executive order, involves dealing with the homeless population, drug addicted population, and the mentally ill, because a lot of times, you know, police have interactions with, you know, that demographic, and is that a police officer's job?
And do they have the training?
Because right.
A lot of times when you're dealing with mental health issues, you're someone who's suffering from mental health issues or domestic violence situation, even putting that kind of, or inserting that kind of presence into a situation, often escalates it just by the mere fact that they're there versus sending in a professional who actually knows how to walk it back, so to speak. You know, if you're dealing with someone who has mental health challenges, could we not first call someone who has, you know, professional credentialing in that area? You know, these situations do sometimes become violent. Sometimes you have a domestic violence situation where the violence is happening at that time. So certainly you might need law enforcement, you know, in that case. But is that the first level of engagement before you go in guns blazing?
They do have training, and they are, you know, advised to get a hold of, say, children's services if there are children involved, social workers there, and also mental health facilities in an emergency. But I guess people are calling for more of that And yeah, also and that often, officers be required to take
exactly.
that as opposed
and establish what the protocol is, because generally right, when protocol. Services are called in, it's to remove the children from the scene for their own protection. And then by the time the mental health professionals get there, it's, you know, because they're determining where they're, what facility they're going to send this person to, or there has to be a determination. They're already incarcerated and there has to be some evaluation to determine if this person should actually be in a mental health facility versus in prison. So, you know, having that level of engagement and assessment on the ground in real time and give them an opportunity to diffuse and evaluate before there is that kind of engagement. Because often you then have legal repercussions behind that. Has been arrested. You know, do they need to be bailed out of jail? You know, then you get back into that economic dynamic of, you know, what are their resources? What, you know, how can they actually manage this? And do they get locked in the system because they simply can't meet the requirement? Yeah, exactly. And so, and have that opportunity to be moved into, you know, another situation and get the treatment that they deserve versus just being incarcerated.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of opportunities. And I think when we're looking at things like you said, after school programs, you know, all of these are budget appropriations, you know, and I don't remember who actually said it, but someone said the greatest moral document of this country is our budget. Whether you're talking about a state budget or, you know, the federal budget, although the federal government is not required to balance their budget, but they still do have one, and there's still a reflection of how we spend our resources. Mm-hmm. And that speaks volumes in terms of what we think is important and how we decide to manage ourselves as a society. You know, if we're putting the most amount of money into policing, does that mean that that is going to be our response and recourse that we take for all of the ills of society? You know, we need to provide opportunities for the police to be the last resort versus the first resort. And I think that comes into play when you have a higher investment in after-school programs, in education, period, in jobs training programs, you know, in addressing the ills of our society that are creating criminal activity and criminal engagement because people feel they have no other recourse. They're not able to find, to, you know, to find the resources to take care of their families or themselves even.
Well, I've seen in my own life, in my own extended family, this has to come up again at some point. The mentally ill, there just is, you know, back when Reagan was president, he closed all of the mental hospitals.
Exactly.
And now you have short-term care for the mentally ill, and then they're just put back on the street or back into a home with family members who don't have the ability to manage their behaviors. So I wonder how that issue might come into play in this election.
I think it definitely comes into play. There's a significant portion of our incarcerated population that really should be having their mental health issues addressed. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot. A chunk of that population comes from homeless people who are suffering from mental illness. And that connects to how our health system is set up and the challenges that we have there, because often you can't get care if you don't have an address. You can't get, you know, insurance. Certainly you're not employed. So all of that just exacerbates that situation that can lead to criminal engagement because you're unable to access resources to, you know, to right the ship of your life, so to speak.
Right. I also know that a large percentage of the prison population, and I can't say exactly how much, there are those kids who have aged out of foster care. 75% of the kids who age out of foster care at age 18, and now in some states 21, mm-hmm. end up either homeless, incarcerated, or unfortunately dead.
Mm-hmm. Sad. Yeah.
It's very sad. So that's why foster care has been extended to age 21 in a lot of states and in Ohio just a couple of years ago, so that those kinds of funding can stay in place longer to help them get on their feet.
And even some of the systems that we have put in place to address those things, It's not just that they're onerous, but often you don't have what it takes to even approach that system to get the help that you need. You know, especially when you're talking about people who are formerly incarcerated. Do you have a driver's license? Can you find a place to live? You know, you have to have an address in order to be able to access these supportive resources to feed yourself or to find housing that's supported by the government. And can you live in that housing if you're a felon? So, you know, there are all kinds of obstacles that we need to look at, even still, moving aside, if we really want to help people meet the standard that we say we're establishing as a country that provides a, you know, a livable wage, a standard of living that's acceptable for all people, you know, including people who have made bad decisions, but, you know, they've served their time.
Right,
and,
right.
And they're coming back. Do you want them to make a better life or not?
The recidivism rate, you know, giving people opportunities upon release to obtain skills, housing opportunity, you know, the recovery for addiction, and, you know, halfway houses that provide these opportunities and job skills. It's been shown to reduce the recidivism rate tremendously. I worked with a program here in Akron, Ohio, that showed tremendous progress, tremendous drop in the recidivism rate. And that only makes sense, right?
For sure.
So, you know, the whole community is safer as a whole.
Absolutely.
Reducing the recidivism rate.
Absolutely. And that, again, was the point of all of the collateral sanctions legislation. You know, we even had programs where people were studying things, you know, like being barbers, but then they were coming out and they weren't able to get a barber's license. Why would you have a program inside a penal institution training people for employment that they're not going to be able to get licensed for? Mm-hmm. That doesn't even make sense. There were barriers to licenses that didn't have anything to do with what the people did. So here in Ohio, we established a nexus. You know, if there was not any correlation, if you were embezzling, you know, or stole money from a bank or whatever, you're probably not going to work in the bank. That makes sense. I mean, there's an actual connection to that. But, you know, you can't exclude people from every single opportunity there is simply because they had engagement with the penal system.
Right.
That's not going to work. No, there's not any opportunity for success there. You know, and back to the opportunity to recover, and, you know, people have to, they immediately slap your child support fines on you when you, you know, when you've come out of prison, but you haven't gotten your driver's license back yet, and you can't because you're behind on your child support. But without that driver's license, you can't get the job. You can't get housing. You know, it's
it's a catch 22.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we really didn't have to step back and look at how these things connected and where we were creating obstacles that people could not overcome. And on the front end of it, before when they initially engaged the criminal justice system, it was a sentencing reform. And that was the first part of the legislation that I worked on, was trying to put some balance back into that. We'd gone so far in terms of mandates that there really wasn't any point in having a judge on the bench anymore because we'd removed all the discretion. You know, if this happened, this is what the penalty was. This is how many years they sentenced for. So, you know, judges didn't have the opportunity to do their own sentencing, but more importantly, to do any diversion to second chance programs, to have them incarcerated closer to home where they could go through some training programs. You know, it's like when people are low-level offenders, you want to turn them around as quick as possible. You don't want to put them in a situation or a system that's going to make them professional criminals. And that's what we were doing.
I found, by the way, the name of that young man that you were talking about earlier, yes. Khalif Browder.
Thank you. That's him.
Yes. He was... allegedly stole a backpack, was held in jail at Rikers Island for 3 years. He was beaten by other inmates. He was put into solitary confinement a number of times and ultimately committed suicide.
Yeah, those kinds of outcomes are unacceptable, especially when people aren't even getting their due process. And
I'm sorry, I think he maybe committed suicide after being released, 6 months after he left. Yes.
Gotcha. Want to do an anchor break?
Sure.
Okay.
We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for staying with us, everybody. I'm going to jump into a subject that was requested by one of our listeners, which is part of this larger conversation. Not going to spend a great deal of time on this because as I was really researching this, we could do an entire show on just reparations. But just, I hope everyone understands reparations, and I'm just going to give the definition. I found a great resource if anyone's interested in really reading about the history of this and what's happening and really getting a great perspective on how reparations can, should, and could impact the lives of African Americans in this country. There's a policy brief that was done by the Brookings Institute, and the authors are Rashawn Ray and Andre Perry. So please take the time to look into that because it's far more information than I can go into today. But just as a start, reparations, a system of redress for egregious injustices, not foreign to the United States. Native Americans have received land and billions of dollars for various benefits and programs for being forcibly exiled from their native lands. For Japanese Americans, $1.5 billion was paid to those who were interred during World War II. Additionally, the United States, via the Marshall Plan, helped to ensure that Jews received reparations for the Holocaust, including making various investments over time. In 1952, West Germany agreed to pay 3.45 billion Deutschmarks to Holocaust survivors. Here in the United States, we actually did have reparations. And hold on, I want to get this exactly correct. First major opportunity that the United States had to atone was after the Civil War. And Sherman actually signed Field Order 15 that allocated 400,000 acres and confiscated federal land to black families. Additionally, some families were to receive mules that were left over from the war. So that is the 40 acres and a mule where this whole concept came from. Subsequent to that, after President Lincoln's assassination, President Andrew reversed Field Order 15 and returned the land back to the former slave owners. So that was not something that actually became a legacy within the African-American community as it was rescinded. So the concept of reparations is really about giving people an opportunity to get level set.
Yeah.
But here in this country, we talked about this a little bit in the first episode when we were talking about some of the institutional racism that exists. So let's say the 40 acres and a mule had stood. How would that have impacted the legacy of African Americans in this community? Would it have been in this country? Would it have been a benefit? Absolutely, would have been a benefit. Would it have been the cure-all? No. It would not have been the cure-all. Now, is that to say that it shouldn't have continued or that we shouldn't address that now? No, because we have done that. I mean, we have done that for other populations and other situations. So not saying that we should not have that or should not get that compensation at this point.
I think that reparations that are paid to repair what was done wrong are not just, you know, monetary or material, they're psychological.
Absolutely.
Psychological atonement.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had opportunities throughout the course of time, the New Deal, where we were talking about, you know, what happened with redlining. I mean, there was an opportunity to do some level setting there. You know, there have been movements within this country that had the disparity between the white and black community been recognized, continued to do some level setting here. Affirmative action is a part of that.
Right.
That's an effort to do some leveling of the playing field, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
However, it still goes back to the institutions and how we are socially conditioned, mentally and emotionally in this country, in terms of how we engage one another. Because it is not just money. It is access to all of those things that surround the opportunity to access and build wealth as a community. You know, redlining, you know, from the, you know, the 20s through the 60s, and still actually happens. A big part of that, you know, the inequity in education is a big part of that, you know, and the fact that, at least in Ohio, we're still based on a property tax structure.
Yes.
So of course, you're going to have inequity because wealthier communities are going to have more money going into their system. So should reparations be a part of the conversation? And would that be fair? I absolutely think so. But without us addressing the other systemic and institutional challenges, there still will continue to be obstacles and blocks to access to even turn that wealth over and make the most of that opportunity, because there won't be access to the same means, programs, institutions.
I've heard, you know, as a white person, I can say, and I'm sure you've heard this too, people say, well, you know, why do I need to pay reparations? I didn't own slaves. True. I never owned slaves, and you were never a slave. But when you really know the history and you study, which again, I'll say, I've been very much enlightened just in the research I've done lately and read just in preparation for our podcasts. It's more than material. It's a psychological, you know, after the Civil War ended, it was like, okay, you're not a slave anymore. Good luck.
Right.
Go get a job.
Exactly.
You have no skills beyond physical labor.
You were neither a slave nor owner, nor was I a slave, but we're both still directly impacted by the legacy of slavery, positively and negatively.
Right. I have white privilege.
Right. And I suffer from racism. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, how much education you have, because it comes down to skin color.
Everywhere you go, you're black.
Exactly. Can't change that. Can't change that. And there are a lot of wealthy black people that can tell you that their wealth has not protected them or insulated them from the repercussions of racism. So let's transition into what our two presumptive presidential candidates are saying about this.
Well, President Trump addressed this with his executive order on June 16th. I have a copy of the executive order. I've studied the executive order. Well, first, just explain what an executive order is. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite sure what the difference was between that and a law. So an executive order is a federal directive issued by the president, and he simply needs to sign it to make it effective. It can be overturned by Congress if it's found to be unconstitutional, whereas a law has the same effect but is passed by Congress. So what this executive order says, essentially, is there are three significant pieces to safe policing for safe communities. The first one is the federal government is to set up independent third-party credentialing agencies that will hold state and local police accountable to certain standards. Now, how will they hold them accountable? They will withhold federal funding from state and local police departments that don't pass certification from these credentialing agencies. So the U.S. Attorney General is William Barr in charge of setting up these credentialing agencies or securing them. And so in order to pass certification, local law enforcement agencies, they must abide by certain use of force policies. And this is what people were looking for. Regarding chokeholds specifically, the executive order does not ban chokeholds nationwide. So I want to make that clear. It does say that if the local policing agencies do not ban the use of chokeholds, except in those situations where the use of deadly force is allowed by law, then they will not receive federal funding. So it just says they can't receive certification, hence no federal funding if they don't limit the use of chokeholds. So how much do local police rely on federal funding? Well, quite a bit, it turns out. $400 million was allotted in 2020 alone just for hiring new officers through it's called COPS COPS program. Also, grants are available for new cruisers, vests, guns, capital improvements, all kinds of things that local law enforcement gets federal funding for. The second significant piece of the executive order is about information sharing. You know how you've been hearing in the news that certain bad cops lose their job and then just simply go to another precinct or another,
right.
So this is to address that problem. So this piece puts in place a database of law enforcement officers who have been criminally convicted, terminated, or decertified for improper use of force. Of course, this is so important because, like I said, one of the problems, you know, that has been that officers get terminated by one policing agency only to be hired by another. So
right,
this is designed to prevent that.
Talking about the police department and talking about racism, you have the same dynamics. When you're trying to have conversation with white people about racism, it's challenging because of the connotation of the word racist. People don't want any implication or to make any admission that there's anything racist within them. So that makes it difficult to have genuine, authentic conversations because that word has such a heavy negative connotation. On the other side, you have the same dynamic with the police departments when you're talking about reforms and bad police officers, because good police officers don't want to be perceived as condoning bad behavior. But, you know, it's kind of like if you're wearing that blue uniform, you're getting brushed with a broad brush, but they have to come out, just like we're asking white people to come out and take a stand, pick a side, and be vocal about it, about being anti-racist. Police have to come out and do the same thing within their community about being anti-bad cops. And, you know, that insulation and protection of them has to stop, because otherwise there's no way to make the distinction. If there aren't measures put in place so that there are repercussions, swift and severe, for these kinds of activities, and police draw a line, and the line is not between the police and the community, but between good and bad, this is going to be difficult to overcome.
Right. The third significant piece deals with mental health, homelessness, and addiction. So we already talked about that earlier. This states that local police should provide training for officers on how to deal with those populations. Now, Trump, he's the self-proclaimed, you know, law and order president. He seems to be taking the stance more from his tweets about when the looting starts, the shooting starts, with regard to the protests. So he's addressing this from more of a law and order standpoint, whereas, right, you know, Biden has a different approach. Trump's approval rating has been dropping. According to a Gallup poll, it was in April as high as 42%. Now, this is throughout coronavirus, right?
Right.
In May, it had dropped to 40%, and in June to 38%. A 2% drop each month for 3 months.
Right. That's pretty significant, you know. But the judgment is on how he has or has not managed the pandemic. That's where people are actually expressing their support or lack of support, is based on how he handled it.
Well, I think this is still going to be significant come November. We're still going to be dealing with coronavirus.
Absolutely. Still dealing with coronavirus and still dealing with, you know, again, the defunding of the police and all of that. So, and regardless of why people are supporting or not supporting, that's definitely going to translate into votes, you know, come November. So all very important for sure.
So how is Biden addressing Black Lives Matter?
So Biden is taking more of an accountability versus law and order approach to this, and tied again to directly to funding, which Trump did some of that as well. But Biden's approach is not, he absolutely is opposed to defunding the police, especially when you're talking about just eliminating a police department. And I think we need to clarify that too. Defunding the police, I think, may have been the worst slogan for this whole thing, because it just immediately threw up a barrier in terms of how police would receive this, because then the understanding is, okay, defund the police. If there's no money, there's no police force. And so I think that was really a challenging way to present that, because now we're, you know, kind of reeling it back in and trying to determine and define what does defunding the police mean. So no one's talking about eliminating the police, but what Biden's talking about is just establishing conditions to reform that are connected to funding, tying federal funding to how they are performing in terms of transparency, where there are situations of misconduct, excessive force, all of that, creating a database that's directly connected to the Justice Department so that we can prevent those things like police hopping from department to department, you know, if they do actually get fired, but also to make sure that there are consequences. So there aren't situations like in the Floyd case where you have an officer who has been called on the carpet, so to speak, 17 times and never convicted. So there is some external source to monitor that, not just the local police force.
And I want to mention that Trump's executive order stopped short of that. It doesn't mention any consequences.
Exactly. So his consequence basically is the, you know, continuing to withdraw more and more funds. Certainly supports the expansion of body cameras. There was a conversation with one reporter where he was asked about, you know, citizen cameras. Not to say that people should stop recording, but that can't be what we rely on to monitor police, that, you know, the body cameras were established for that specific reason, and that we should just expand that policy. Sensitivity training is something that he was really focused on. National use of force standards to establish that, and for that to be the standard across the board so that we don't have all of, you know, these different standards. So if you drive across one county or one state, whatever, you know, the standard is different.
Yeah.
Shifting funding from, and again, this goes to his kind of prevention more than the law and order comparison that you'd made, shifting funding to crime prevention, mental health, drug treatment, more social workers, into addressing the homeless populations, education programs, housing programs, after school and summer programs. So to prevent young people from getting into that criminal pipeline early, dealing with the correlations that we already know and are aware of between education and the prison pipeline. So, you know, funding and creating a more equitable funding system for education. So yeah, just more focus on crime prevention than that hard-handed, you know, law and order kind of thing. And not just dealing with that regular funding, but funding of program, like the burn grants, the COP programs, putting more specifically, he called out the number of $300 million into community policing programs. Mm. Very specific about treatment versus incarceration for drug offenses. And, you know, and not necessarily when we're talking about drug dealers, but people that are arrested for connected criminal offenses because they are, you know, trying to get money to actually buy drugs. So putting them into mandatory rehabilitation programs versus incarceration. And the requirement to de-escalate and demilitarize, and he did have the ban on chokeholds. And I'd say probably about half of his line up with the Eight Can't Wait legislation that has been proposed, and also in line with what has been presented and passed, I think, at this point in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Okay. It sounds like, you know, a lot of the same stuff that is mentioned in President Trump's executive order, however, much more specific.
Yeah, and that's the part that kind of concerns me on both sides, too, not just with President Trump, but looking for a little more specificity on Biden's side also in terms of who is going to be executing, you know, these changes, who's going to be, you know, the authority for accountability for these, and, you know, really speaking more to that legislative partnership as well.
There's something of note also, forgot to mention, in President Trump's executive order. There are three people on his executive staff that he mentions in the executive order that are responsible for setting up these things. And it's the Attorney General, William Barr, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy are all mentioned. Those are three white guys. Just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah.
Just thought maybe he could have put an African-American in some way.
Somewhere in the mix. You know, same thing happens when we're dealing with women's issues too, you know. It's generally a lot of white guys determining what's best for us. And I believe that speaks to a lot of the challenge that we've had just universally and historically in a racial situation. You can't have conversations about Black Lives Matter, police brutality, engagement with the Black community, anything that has to do with the African-American community absent African-Americans at the table.
Does that concern you?
Sure, it concerns me no matter what the subject is, when you don't have representatives from the population that you're trying to support, or, you know, or even people who work in that area.
Well, as an African American, does it concern you with regard to this executive order?
Oh, sure it does. Because it, to me, it speaks to your ability to really come up with the appropriate solutions. You know, I'm not even going to question your intent. I'm not even going to question the fact that you didn't recognize that you've got three white guys that are in charge of this issue with the African-American community. But what it absolutely says is you can only go so far, no matter how well-intentioned you could be. If I give you the benefit of the doubt, you know, at the highest level, you're only going to get so far because you don't have any African-Americans as part of this reform conversation.
Mm-hmm. And what I see is Trump is addressing this on the level of the symptoms, as opposed to Biden, who seems to be more concerned with listening, addressing
well, causation
of cause.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's where we have to kind of bring the two together. You know, in the immediate response, we do have to deal with the symptoms, because the symptoms are what are getting people killed. But to have a long-term reformative process that really addresses the root of the problem and gets to racism and deals with those systemic issues, then we do have to deal with the causation part of it as well.
Sure.
It's a big thing, and it's not going to go away. We'll have conversations about this again as we get closer to the election. But I think they both have a long way to go. You know, we're 5 months out. 5 months is a long time in any election, especially when you're talking about a presidential election. The two biggest issues on the table will still be on the table come November. And, you know, that's COVID and Black Lives Matter. So they're both going to have to be very clear in what their positions are and what their intentions are to address
that. I think
Biden is going to have to make it real clear what he plans to do. And President Trump is going to have to make it very clear what he has done, because, you know, even though we are now reopening, you know, there are areas of the country where there are spikes still happening. So we're, you know, back and forth yo-yoing with that. And, you know, there's been a lot of challenges around what can he take credit for? What did he do? What did he do too late? You know, when you compare us to the rest of the world, hugely disproportionate in terms of how COVID impacted us, especially being the country that we are with the healthcare options that we have.
I think it says a lot that his approval ratings have been dropping since April. It coincides with COVID-19, right? And then our demographic that we're our audience of women over 50, who's by far number one priority in terms of the policy issues is healthcare. You know, well, how is this going to impact their vote? Mm-hmm. I also think, you know, that so many young people have been out with these protests and such. How will that translate at the polls? I know the march that I attended, there were speakers as well as signs that said, mm-hmm. protest, then vote.
Right.
So, and in the 2016 election, only 13% of our population under the age of 30 actually voted. Mm-hmm. We'll see some polls coming up soon. We'll keep our audience informed about what it looks like if these kids are going to take their protest to the ballot.
Exactly. So, yeah, 5 months and counting. We will continue to talk to you about the issues that we, women over 50, mm-hmm. are saying are important to us, and how they're relevant in the upcoming election and in what races, because this is a presidential year, but we can't forget those down ballot races, because they all impact those top two things, both of which really are health issues, because racism has been determined to be a health concern in many communities. It's being identified as such. So how do we respond to that? But all of the issues of economics, health, who we find to be trustworthy, the things that we say are important to us as women over 50, we're going to be looking at all of that and talking about who bears the responsibility for being responsive to that, from, you know, the mayor all the way to the president, and encouraging you to take a look at that and giving you information to consider as you make your decisions.
That's right. And be sure to give us feedback. Again, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I want to give a shout out to our technical producer, Cade Hessman. We love Cade. He helps us get this thing up and running. He helps us, you know, whenever we don't know how to turn on our audio when we're doing this via Zoom, because Tracy and I are still social distancing.
Yes.
That word is driving me crazy every time I hear it. It's like the painting, the scream. I just want to say, no more. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Please stay tuned, ladies. We are Women with Issues, and we're talking to you.
Bye-bye.